Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guest today is Craig Renault. He's one half of the Renault brothers. They are a documentary filmmaking team. They've done all kinds of stories for the New York Times, Vice News, HBO. They've gotten an Emmy nomination. They've won a Peabody, and they've addressed tough issues like the drug cartels, Iraq, school integration in Little Rock, the earthquake in Haiti, and so many more. So we talk about what it's like making a living as a documentary filmmaker, their techniques for going into these danger zones and surviving, how to get the interviews in those situations without making yourself too conspicuous, how to build trust with the subjects you're interviewing, and get them to talk about really personal things or risky things that they are a part of. All that and more coming up in our interview with Craig Renault. Stick around. This is the N. Savvides podcast.
Hello, hello, hello.
Welcome to the N. Savvides podcast, Craig Renault.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You and your brother make a living as freelance documentary filmmakers. And sometimes you're spending a year or more on some of the stories you cover. How do you pick the stories for your documentaries?
Some of the stories come out of other stories that we've done. And one of the things that we tend to do is to keep going back to places and digging deeper and deeper. You know, some examples of that are Chicago and Juarez, Mexico. You know, those are two places we've reported a lot. And sometimes we might start off in a place reporting for the New York Times and then keep going back to those stories and trying to dig deeper and deeper. For example, in Chicago, where we're producing a film right now, you know, we've been working there for 10 years and have probably produced four or five projects out of there. And we really believe in continuing to do that. I think it makes the story stronger and you know, your contacts are stronger in those places and you get to where you really care about the subject matter and the things that are happening there. So that's one of the ways, you know, occasionally we'll have networks that we've worked with for a long time come to us with story ideas, but it's usually us continuing to develop stories in places that either we want to work or that we have worked quite a bit.
You mentioned the New York Times. You all have also worked with Vice and HBO and some other entities. I was wondering if you could describe to us your pitching process with companies like that.
We don't have any problems anymore calling people up and getting meetings and talking about these projects and pitching it to them. That doesn't mean that they will always do it, but you know, we've been around long enough and done enough films and won enough awards that we are able to do that. And so that helps. You know, early on in our career, that was much harder. I think what really helped us early on is that we always filmed and edited and wrote all of our own material, you know, and so we could get a project going for very little money. And that would be my advice, you know, especially like really young filmmakers starting out, always say to learn how to edit, because that's something that eats up so much of your budget if you have to hire editors to work on your stuff. And so, you know, earlier in our career, what we would do is if we were interested in a subject matter, we would just invest enough time and money to go to that place and shoot for a week or two and try to develop our characters. And, you know, it's pretty much impossible these days to walk in to a meeting and just have an idea on paper. You pretty much have to have something to show with fully developed characters. And it also helps you as a filmmaker, make sure this is something you really have access to and test the access on that. And so earlier in our careers, that's what we would do. We'd go to a place, film with the characters and stay with it, and then put together a couple minute reel that we could then shop around and show people. And then the other thing, I think you have to have a couple of projects going or a couple of ideas that you're developing at the same time. You know, early in our career, we would work hard to get a meeting with a network, and you'd go in there and they'd say, okay, what do you have for us? And you say two ideas and they're not interested in any one, and then your meeting's over. You might have a couple of things that you've actually shot and developed, but you should also have three or four other ideas that you're interested in that you've looked into that you can talk about, you know, because if you catch their ear with something, they're like, okay, we'll give us a month, we'll come back to you. And then you go work really hard and come back to them with something and hope that they haven't change their mood or appetite by the time you get back to them. But for us, it's just about staying busy and being able to shoot and edit everything yourself, you know, so that you're not relying on 4 or 5 months or 6 months to get a grant where you can afford to hire an editor or be able to travel somewhere. We just tend to kind of jump into stories that we find access to and try to quickly develop them.
You all seem willing to put yourselves in the midst of danger to get a story, even going so far as sitting on top of a tank when the story calls for it. What have you learned about staying alive in those conflict zones?
You know, it's really just the experience of doing it and knowing what is really dangerous and what isn't, and knowing when to take those risks. For somebody that's never done it, it probably looks much more dangerous than it is. And of course, you can lose your life doing that, and journalists do all the time. But if you've done it enough, you know what those calculated risks are and what you're willing to do. You know, we certainly don't just jump into a place without having done a lot of research. We don't go into certain situations without being embedded, or you don't go to Juarez, Mexico at the height of the violence there when we used to work there, when there 3,000 people were being killed a year. You know, we did very extensive research before we showed up about who are the security people or the fixers that we're going to work with and what's the best way to do that. And, you know, and the more you work in an area, the more you get used to it. You really got to listen to the people that you're working with who live there and work there. You know, if they tell you it's time to leave a place, you get in the car and you leave and you listen to them.
Has there ever been a situation like that where they're like, hey, you need to leave right now?
Oh, absolutely. Whereas when we were working there during the height of the violence, that would happen all the time, you know, where the guy that we really trusted, his main job was really just watching our backs while we were filming. And if he saw somebody or something suspicious, he would whisper in our ear that it's time to leave, and we would listen to him. Those sorts of things. And just making sure wherever you're working that you're really prepared. And, you know, and you develop, after years of doing this, you develop kind of a sense of when things are not comfortably safe, and you avoid those situations. We're patient. I mean, Brent was just in Libya where he was waiting on a transport of somebody, and he got a tip that the guys that were about to pick him up might be working with ISIS, and he wasn't sure about it. And so he waited an extra 24 hours for somebody else to come pick him up. So if you're not patient, you might walk into a bad situation.
It seems that the development of these high quality compact cameras helps the kind of work you do. And it seems like the film community is aware of that technology, but talk a little bit about some of the discrete audio options in those kind of situations.
Yeah, I mean, I would my advice to filmmakers who are just getting started is invest in good audio more than anything else, because, you know, you can get away with somewhat subpar video. You really can't get away with bad audio if you're trying to get something on a network or something that people won't cringe in a film festival. And so it is really important to invest in good audio gear. And but our method of filming is really simple. It's a simple approach. We always have a wireless microphone or two that we can put on the main subjects. So that—
which models are you using, if you don't mind saying?
I don't know the exact model number. We tend to use Letrosonics or Sony's. Sony makes some really good inexpensive ones that if you're going to really, you know, beat them up, I think they're like the 810 models or something like that. Those are very inexpensive and good quality. And then if you want to invest more, you can get into Letrosonic mics, which really work well at wide ranges and are smaller mics. And so we have, you know, different variety of microphones. But I mean, the main point is just to always use a wireless. You know, I've seen filmmakers that are shooting the entire thing on a shotgun microphone. And if you're trying to do Verite stuff like we're doing, it's almost impossible to do that, because, you know, we really like to put a wireless on somebody and disappear and stay a little bit back and shoot a little bit at a distance. If you're relying on just shotgun microphones, you're going to have a very hard time doing that. And you're always going to be interfering with the footage, because you're going to have to be so close to people with the microphone. It's just hard to mix that because it's loud. And, you know, our shotguns are really just more for ambience and getting some audio from somebody who's not your main character that's interacting is what we use it for. But we really try to always have people mic'd if there are main subjects.
Some filmmakers, artists, reporters might stay away from the challenging topics. It seems like you and your brothers explore them head on, sometimes taking on several hot button issues at a time, like immigration, education, gun violence, race relations, and drug use. Those are some of the ones that I've noticed. So what's your approach when taking on a challenging, complicated topic in documentary form?
Yeah, I mean, we really care about these topics. If you had to describe in a short soundbite what we do, is we try to take stuff that's in the headlines and go a lot deeper and put a face on it. These are big topic issues that we care about, but, you know, for example, the violence in Chicago. I mean, you hear national headlines all the time about how violent of a summer it was in Chicago, you know, and so we just spent the summer in Chicago filming. When we do it, we're in the neighborhoods with the people and, you know, and really trying to figure out what is causing it and not just doing kind of sensational news stories that don't go deeper than that. So that's pretty much always our approach, is you find some relatable characters and you really get to know them and really get their trust and you just stick with them. And through those voices, you know, I think you can really learn a lot about some of these bigger topics that are being covered by the news. But a great part of documentaries is helping people understand what's really behind these issues.
I've noticed that your work can be used by people on both sides of an issue. Sometimes they'll gravitate to something in one of your projects.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, do you and your brother like to get involved in the surrounding political discussions? Or do you feel like that's not part of your job?
We really don't. We try to stick to that true objective form. For example, when we did Off to War in Iraq, if you watched that whole series, you probably wouldn't have that strong of a sense of where our political beliefs lie and that, you know, in the production of that. I remember when we came back from filming Off to War, which was a 10-part series for Discovery Channel that we filmed in Iraq, embedded with this one unit. In the first couple of episodes where the soldiers, you know, were talking about their reasons for going to Iraq and we were attacked on 9/11 and that sort of thing. And then when we showed it at a film festival, we had people stand up angry saying, well, why didn't you correct those guys when they talked about it? And we said, well, that's not our job. You know, we almost see this as a historical document for the war that was taking place. And that's what we were doing, is documenting their perspective about why they were going. And if you watch the entire 10-part series, 4 episodes later, you're going to see those exact same soldiers pick up a newspaper and find out that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11 and question why they're there. And so, you know, we really are just trying to document what's going on and not really take a political side. There's filmmakers that do that and do that well. But we feel like we can reach a broader audience by just putting it out there and letting people make up their own minds.
Along those lines, in one of the pieces you did for the New York Times on Juarez, Mexico, one of the editors of a Mexican newspaper, El Diario, says that without journalists, there are no democracies. So I was wondering if you'd care to comment on that in relation to your own work.
Absolutely. The particular story that you're talking about, we went to Juarez and we did a story about the journalists there who were risking their lives every day. And at this time, journalists were being killed by the cartels for connecting dots between the cartel members and politicians and that sort of thing. And so El Diario in particular had lost 2 journalists. And we went out with some of these brave journalists to show, you know, the extraordinary risks that they were taking reporting every day. I mean, it's very different when you're a foreign journalist and you pop into a place like that and your family isn't there, they don't live there, and you can get out when somebody tells you to get out. These guys were living in Juarez with their families there and going out and literally reporting on cartel members who they knew were very capable of getting to them and killing them and had killed their fellow reporters. And absolutely. I mean, especially in a place like Mexico at that time. Now the violence is way down. And you just think about, if there weren't journalists to report on that stuff, you really wouldn't be having any clue to what was going on. And same is true for our democracy right now as well. I mean, it's the foundation of our democracy. So we absolutely believe in that.
So your videos help to inform people who participate in the voting process and get involved in government.
Yeah, we don't really sit around and think about it that philosophically. You know, I think we're storytellers and we like doing important stories. And if we have an impact, then that's great. And if that gets used to some positive end, that's fantastic. We're not activist filmmakers in the sense where we say, okay, we really want to make a change and about this particular topic, and we go do that. It's more about telling a very heartfelt story and trying to understand an issue. And it's great when that something results out of that.
I'm curious about your code of ethics. In some cases, the people that you're interviewing are doing illegal things, or they are being persecuted by the cartels, perhaps. So how do you determine who gets included, who gets blurred out? Is that entirely based on who signs the release, or are there other factors at work?
I mean, if you're watching our films and you see somebody blurred out, a lot of times it's based on releases, but there are occasions where, for example, if we go home with our security guy in Juarez, Mexico, and we're eating dinner with his family, you know, that's a conversation that we have with them and consider their safety. So in that particular instance, we're at the dinner table with the guy who keeps us safe in Juarez, and we made a decision to blur the family's face because we didn't want something we were doing to put his family at risk. There's other times where we'll edit out something completely. I remember in Dope Sick Love, one of the films that we did for HBO, we've shot this really powerful scene with one of the addicts we were following and their kids. We made a collective decision with HBO to not include that in the documentary because we felt it was unfair for these, you know, kids that were under the age of 10 to have it broadcast on national television that their parents were living on the streets as addicts and involved in prostitution and that sort of thing. And so it's all a case-by-case basis. We're not afraid to cover hard-hitting subjects and controversial or uncomfortable things, but you know, we do care about people and the subjects that we're filming, and so we definitely take all that into account when we're editing.
I want to take a quick break from our conversation with Craig Renaud to share a special message with you. Have you ever thought to yourself, this Ensavides podcast, so interesting, so intriguing, I wish I could be on this show? Well, you know, now you can. If you like the show, shoot me an email, podcast@ensavides.com. Tell me what you like about the show and a favorite episode. The response I find most compelling will get to come on the show during this section, and you get to tell us a little bit about you, about what you do, business, recreation, hobby, whatever. Just a chance for you to introduce yourself to our friendly listeners. So once again, the email for that is podcast@ensavides.com. We'll keep that going for a few weeks just to see what comes in. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Craig Renaud. I am captivated by the relationship you and your brother seem to form with your subjects when they are opening up about painful things, or again, willing to let you follow along as they're putting themselves at risk or doing questionable behaviors. So how do you go about building those relationships?
You know, I think it's a combination of being willing to spend a lot of time with them. But I think also, I tell young filmmakers all the time, is people can sense when you're being earnest and sincere. People can sense when you have an agenda. And so if you're really pure in terms of the story you're trying to tell, and if you're really just honestly trying to tell their story, then I think they can sense that and you build a relationship with them. And so we've really never had that much issues getting people to trust us because I think we approach it very sincerely. That's just always worked for us. I mean, we do what we say we're going to do, and we don't have an agenda going into it except for to tell their story. And it helps also that most of our stuff doesn't have narration, and so we're not putting a point of view on it. It's really just editing a story together of what really happened in their lives. And so it's very rare that we have our subjects be upset about something we put in the film. I mean, we have them tell us all the time that, wow, that was really difficult to watch, but you did it accurately, and that's how it happened. And so that's usually our experience with that.
I wanted to touch on Dope Sick Love briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Of all your projects, that was the one that was the most uncomfortable for me to watch. At times, it even felt a little exploitative for mm-hmm. me. And so I was wondering, how you justify something like that. And also, what would you all have done if they had overdosed in such a way that put their lives at risk? Would you have kept shooting then or helped get them aid in that case?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've had that exact same question asked of us so many times about that particular film. And it's kind of like the question about how do we sense or know the danger that we're in. And for example, you're probably thinking of a scene with Michelle and Sebastian where they had been shooting up in this small little corridor of a hallway. You know, it looked like one of them was about to overdose. It's kind of talking to the other addict that's there with them, and they have a very, you know, real sense of if somebody's about to overdose or not. If somebody's about to lose their life, you know, the story is not more important than capturing that. Somebody's life is not less important than capturing some sort of moment, absolutely. You know, and it's a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think if you watch that film, it might seem like those kind of situations arose a lot more than they did, but we were always pretty confident about where that level was at and not crossing it. I remember there was a number of times being out with Michelle when it was freezing cold outside, and she's got holes in her jeans and no socks on. And after we filmed for a little bit, it's like, okay, Michelle, come on, we're going to Kmart and we're buying you a bunch of clothes and that sort of thing. You're going to freeze to death out here. Certainly. I mean, it's just a case by case basis, and you go along with that and try to navigate that and figure it out. He'd also talked about, you know, we're never going to film and participate if they're committing a violent crime. I mean, if they're shoplifting, a lot of times you'd go back in and have conversations with the store where they just shoplifted after the fact and offer to pay for the items because you had witnessed it. And so there's a lot of things like that happen behind the scenes that you have to deal with.
Do you think they were better or worse off for participating in that?
You know, I had a lot of conversations with Michelle after that film. She felt like she had reached a point in her life where she had no personal relationships left anymore, that she had abused all her relationships, and that, you know, she felt like she really wanted to share that story because she felt like that was something she had to give to society or something that she could add was, here's what happens when you become like this. And she felt good about it. And, you know, we talked to all of them. And again, that's a very tough subject matter. And none of them were upset. It might have hurt their ability to pull some of the scams that they were pulling because the authorities locally there in New York were more keen to what they were doing. But none of them had a problem with the content of the film. We keep in touch with all those guys a lot. You know, I was in touch with Michelle up until she died. You know, she passed away a number of years ago, and she had gotten clean for a number of years and was doing really well. And there's a lot of national alcohol and drug treatment centers that use Dope Sick Love all the time in their teachings of counselors and that sort of thing. And they say it's the most real thing that they can show to counselors to help them understand and prepare them for the job that they're going to do with helping people with addictions. And so I do think a lot of good came out of that film.
All right. Encouraging to hear. I did feel like at times they were possibly playing to the camera as if the camera was heightening their actions, but who knows? Anyway, let's talk more about Shelter, which is a film that is easier for me to get behind. I did enjoy that one quite a bit when I had the chance to see it. So how did that story come about?
We filmed a documentary in Chicago called Last Chance High that we did for Vice News that won a Peabody Award. It dealt with kids at this one particular school in Chicago that were there for extreme behavioral issues. And there was a lot of stuff with mental illness and medication with these kids that we really felt like we just barely scratched the surface on it. And we felt like we wanted to go deeper into that subject matter and started talking with Vice about, you know, we'd like to do something more with young people and mental illness because we feel like it's a big issue that doesn't get talked about a lot. And so we started doing research on that, and that's what, you know, we came across the Covenant House in New Orleans and had heard that they were doing all this great work around that issue and started having some conversations over the phone with Jim Kelly, their director, and eventually came down and met with him and, you know, asked him if we could start filming there. And that's how it happened.
And this was another project where you were with your subjects for about a year or so. Mm-hmm. You touched on this earlier, but I was wondering if you'd elaborate on it here. How did you go about building trust with the Covenant House employees and with the patients, some of whom are facing past abuse or mental illness?
You know, it first started with building a relationship with Jim Kelly, who's, you know, he started that Covenant House in New Orleans, you know, some 25 years ago, and is now the executive director of it. And it shows the trust that he had in his staff. When we first started talking about it, you know, we explained the type of films that we make and how immersive it is. And we would need to have full access to the place with our cameras. I remember when we screened this in New Orleans, he said to the audience, just, you know, I just trusted my gut and I believe these guys. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about just being sincere about what you plan to do. And he trusted us and asked his staff to trust us. And I think it also shows this confidence that they had in them, that there was nothing to hide at that place with the work that they were doing. So, you know, we just started hanging out all the time, a lot of times without cameras and talking to all the staff one-on-one. And, you know, you start to get a sense of who's open to participating. And there's some people that are shy and like what you're doing, but don't necessarily want to be on camera. And you can pretty quickly navigate all that and figure out who the staff are that are not only open to it, but interested in being very involved, and you gravitate towards them. And then you start filming. We really never had, I mean, I'd say maybe once or twice we had a young person there not sign a release or participate. And that usually had more to do with not wanting to be found than it did not wanting to participate. So we never really ran across those issues. You know, some people didn't want to go super deep into it, and it's an emergency shelter, so a lot of kids would only be there for a day or two and you'd never see them again. You know, the other ones, you just, same thing as always, you just spend a lot of time with them. Like Elizabeth, we spent so much time with her even without the camera that, you know, I think when you watch the film, you see that she is comfortable with the filming process. And I think at times it was helpful for her to have an ability to reflect on things that were happening with her and sharing her story.
How much time do you spend before you turn on the camera? Is that a few days, a few weeks?
It really depends. I don't think there's not a set formula for it. Like the Covenant House, when you have the blessing of the staff and the director, you know, that helps you more quickly get into the filming, you know. And so you could start with filming with one of the main staff people and then go take it from there and start to kind of gauge your access and when it's appropriate to have the camera out and when it's not. After a long period of time, you know, you're able to capture those really intense scenes or intimate scenes because the staff has developed a trust with you because of the time that you've spent there. And so when they're walking into that closed room to have a very intimate conversation, instead of shutting the door, they're inviting you in because they've come to trust you and believe in the story that you're trying to tell.
You all did spend quite a bit of time with them. So did the story change at all from what you imagined it would be at the start, or it was consistent to what you expected?
I think, it, you know, everything changes as you start to film because you follow different people and different narratives as they develop. But pretty much was what we set out to do, which was just put people in that place. You know, after spending time there, when we came to edit the film, that's kind of an approach that we took, is just dropping people into this place. The first 15 minutes of that film is probably the most intense. And that's really what it's like on a day-to-day basis there. If you were to volunteer at the front desk there for a day, you better be prepared for what the tough situations you're going to deal with. And that's kind of the approach we took in the editing and the experience of filming there, was just to try to show, you know, what the staff is dealing with on a day-to-day basis, the miracles they're trying to work with these kids with very limited resources, and show the empathy and love that staff has, which I think is really apparent when you watch the film.
And speaking of intense situations, I understand that you or your brother got attacked during the making of the film.
Yeah, that was me.
So how do you face something like that and not let it affect your take on it?
I've been in ambushes in Iraq. I've lost count of all the close calls that I've had, and that was the first time I've physically been beaten up badly, but I've certainly been in those situations a lot. And you know what you're filming, you know the risk going into it. You know, I know if I'm in a certain neighborhood in Chicago, I know that there's a chance that I'm going to get jumped because somebody doesn't like the camera because of the drug dealing they're doing or whatever. So when you walk into those situations, you're prepared for that. It would be kind of hypocritical to step into, you know, to be wanting to capture these people's situations in their lives, like the staff and that sort of thing, and not put yourself at this in the same risk. You know, if you're going to be empathetic towards these kids that are suffering from mental illness and witnessing what the staff is going through, then you got to put yourself in those same situations. And if something happens, then that's what happens. And you keep filming. I think if anything, it made me want to tell the story even more. I mean, the kid that attacked me, he had never met me. He had just shown up at the shelter the night before. He was not on his medication. You know, I think he was probably schizophrenic or bipolar and just was really out of sorts and just decided to attack me. After it happened, you know, this happened at a park at Louis Armstrong Park next to the Covenant House. And he walked back over after some kids helped get me up and back over to the Covenant House. He came back over there and told Jim Kelly, the director, that he wanted to have a conversation with me. And I said, okay, sure. And so I went outside and talked to the kid, and he just said, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. I don't know what led me to do that. I was hearing voices. I didn't mean to hurt you. And shook my hand and apologized, and he went over and sat on a bench and started rocking back and forth. You know, wrong place at the wrong time, but you have to be sympathetic and have a lot of empathy for what those kids were going through, and I didn't take it personally. Just kept coming back and filming.
In watching the film, I was surprised by how faith-based the Covenant House is, which makes sense, but they were also open or trying to be respectful to someone who is transgendered. So that was surprising to me. Were there things that surprised you in the making of the film?
Well, I think what we learned and what Jim Kelly helped us understand is that I think, you know, yeah, if you walk in with the assumption that this is a religious organization, I think you're quickly going to learn that that's not how him or the staff approach it. There's a scene where he's addressing this, and I think he says it best, you know, that they're Franciscan than they are anything else. And it's really about helping these vulnerable kids. It has nothing to do with the religion of their staff or the kids or that sort.
And for those who don't know the distinctions, can you elaborate on the Franciscan order and how they see things a little differently?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to articulate it as well as Jim did in the film, but it's not about religiosity. It's having love for the weak and vulnerable more than any specific religion. He says, and there, you know, I can't tell you the particular denominations of my staff or the kids there, but we are going to help the most weak and vulnerable of our society when they come in and they need help. And they're going to help kids that are transgender or kids that have AIDS or whoever comes in their doors. So they really don't approach it with any sort of specific religion or denomination. And that was something that surprised me and made me respect the work they do even more.
Of all the films or work of yours that I've seen, Shelter strikes me as the most hopeful because it explores these challenging issues, but you see noticeable improvement where you don't always see that in other films. And you all even describe it as much. Your description for the film is, the Covenant House of New Orleans is hope. The doors are always open and there is always room for one more. So what's the takeaway? What can others who are trying to contribute to some of society's challenges see from this and use elsewhere?
Particularly in our political climate right now, after the election that we just had, and you know, I think where it can feel like our society lacks compassion, I do think there's a lot of people out there that live their lives on a daily basis, like the staff at Covenant House, where it really is led by compassion and trying to help others. There's nobody at that place that is making much money, but their work is very meaningful, and they're literally saving people's lives every day. And helping somebody like Elizabeth, who for sure would have died on the streets. You know, she's the main character in the film. And when we started filming with her, if they had not intervened and you know, stretched their rules to help her, she definitely would have died. And so I think that's the takeaway. To me, it's just awesome to watch people with that much compassion that can put themselves out there every day. And Miss Foots, who's one of the main staff members featured in the film, you know, she's been doing this job for almost 20 years. And she said after the screening, her husband told her that, now I get it. Now I understand why you're always coming home late. And, you know, why you're so dedicated to these kids. So I thought that was pretty cool that, you know, even a staff member's husband, after seeing that, could have that takeaway that, okay, now I get it.
I want to bring up a comment that an administrator made in Little Rock Central 50 years later, and I wanted to get your take on it. The administrator is talking about school integration, but possibly her comments can apply to other things. She says, it really takes all of us. It takes the family. It takes the community. It takes the school. It takes the child. And that's how we get there. Is that sentiment something you share? And how do you think it relates to some of the challenges we face?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it takes a community. I mean, I live in Arkansas, you know, and I lived in New York for almost 20 years. And with the election that we just had, if you take my surrounding family and my surrounding group of friends, it's pretty much split down the middle of who people voted for. But I am part of a community that can sit down and have conversations about all this stuff and not be at each other's throats or not be heated. And so I do think that's extremely important. And I think it's harder and harder to do that the more that people don't interact with each other, or if their interactions are through social media and that sort of thing. You know, I do think that stuff becomes dangerous.
Yeah, it's sort of like self-selecting isolation from other sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you've got this issue and problem now in social media where what's considered factual news becomes, you know, labeled as some sort of biased conspiracy news. And the stuff that is not factual surfaces to the top and kind of helps people further their feelings about one thing or another. And I think that's very dangerous. I mean, I think, you know, journalists are going to play an increasingly important role. And I think people have to respect that. And I've worked in all these newsrooms of places that are being called, you know, biased media. And most of my friends and peers are journalists. And I know the majority of them do not approach their work that way. Nobody sets out with a political agenda, at least in the news organizations I've worked in. I have never been told by an executive producer to slant my reporting one way or another. That kind of, those conversations just don't come up. It's important for people to realize that, you know, especially when stuff gets so heated politically.
All right. Well, let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you and your brother as filmmakers?
I think we are pretty fortunate as filmmakers. You know, I think all the people that we collaborate with so far have really let us have, you know, a lot of free rein to tell our story. And the times that we do get notes and involvement, it's usually dead on. So I feel very fortunate about that. I really have not had bad experiences. It's hard to do the kind of long format reporting that we're doing now. Not a lot of people get to do that anymore. So I do feel very fortunate that we get, you know, supported doing that. That's the kind of collaborators that we like and want to keep working with, or just, you know, ones that let us do those projects that take a lot of time so that you can really get to know your subjects and the stories that we're trying to tell. We do smaller stories from time to time, but it usually is with the intention of eventually opening that up into something longer. And that's pretty much been our track record. Anytime we've done shorter stories for the New York Times or other places, if you really follow our work, you'll see that most of those got expanded into longer projects.
Yeah, I like it. The deep dive. It's a helpful, valuable thing these days.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Craig, thank you for joining us. People want to learn more about what you all do. Where would they go to find out?
They can go to RenaultBrothers.com or, you know, Renault Brothers on Twitter or Facebook and follow what we're doing. It's R-E-N-A-U-D Brothers.
And what about Shelter? Do you all have any links for that?
Yeah, there's a Shelter Facebook page.
We'll include the links.
Yeah, if you can include that. But yeah, we do have a Facebook page for Shelter. And yeah, we just had our world premiere at the New Orleans Film Festival, which was awesome. We were really happy that we got a jury award and an audience award. And I look forward to getting that out there and letting more people see it.
Yeah. Congratulations on those wins, sir. And thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much, Nick.
All right. And that's my interview with Craig Renault. As you could probably tell from the interview, I really appreciate the work that the Renault brothers are doing in general. That they are taking on these tough issues is enough of an accomplishment, but they are doing it in big ways. They take the deep dives, sometimes spending a year or more to really explore an issue. And that is becoming more and more rare in the media landscape, where everyone seems to have a short attention span. And plus, it costs a little bit more. You have to set aside more time and money to make that happen. So it's encouraging to see that they continue to do that. And there are media organizations that allow their work to exist. I also appreciate their effort of exploring an issue thoroughly and on both sides of the spectrum. I saw a number of their projects, and I couldn't get a sense of an ideological lean. As we mentioned in the interview, both sides of an issue have taken their films and used them to make a point. And when you have a complex issue like the drug trade or education challenges or whatnot, that might happen when you're willing to look at it in a fair, nonpartisan way. Some reporters give lip service to that, where they have a pretty evident bias, I would say, in some cases, not the Renault brothers. And so you heard Craig talking about how he grew up in New York and has family in Little Rock. I can relate to that. I have some family in Arkansas as well, and I was born in New York. So I like to see that combination of values. And to even demonstrate that, on their site, they acknowledge quotes, positive reviews from something like NPR and the Associated Press, but also Fox News and the National Review. If they were partisan, they probably wouldn't do that. They would maybe highlight from one side, here are the nice quotes we got from Slate and Huffington Post, but not from the other. And it's a credit to them that they acknowledge both as valid media sources, not something everyone can do in our polarizing landscape. But this kind of thing, having these thoughtful explorations of complicated issues, is so important. Probably even more so now when things become so polarized. Pretty searing election on both sides. And so it's nice to see that there are people who are trying to transcend that. I did want to touch briefly on Dope Sick Love. That was the one that was the hardest for me to watch, as you heard in the interview. On the one hand, I do appreciate them taking on a tough subject like drugs, like drug addiction. And it does encourage an important conversation. But the thing is, when you have the camera there, when you're documenting, you're a part of it, whether you want to be or not. And it's almost like not intervening is making a statement. It's maybe going along with it, giving implicit approval. I mean, just think about it. When you bring a camera, you see people waving, they react to it. That's one influence. Or the more excessive reality show sensationalism. I don't think that's what they're doing, but there is that aspect of thinking, how does the camera help or affect a situation? Maybe it's not always positive. Now, to be fair, Craig did mention that he cared about the people involved and that he would take time to get clothes for them when they were cold, and that they would follow up with the owners when there was shoplifting involved. So it seems like they did think about these things and did have some guidelines in place. It's just one of those things that is worth discussing. Where do you draw the line? When to step in and intervene and not just let someone do something that is questionable behavior? But then again, it is a film that, as Craig said, has been used by rehab facilities to try to show others what the addict experience is like. So it's complicated. Where to draw the line, I don't know. But in contrast, let's look at the shelter, because there's also some drug use there, but it's a little bit easier for me to embrace the depiction of it in that film. In Shelter, the people in the film are actively caring about people. They talk about how much they love others, love the people they're serving. And I would suggest that's one reason why that film feels more hopeful. The people involved are actually helping to try to make things better. That's not an easy thing to do, especially when we are hurting. We have our own struggles and we see someone else and they are struggling. It's like, oh, I can't always be that person. But it's a nice ideal to aim for. I've been thinking more about that in context of what I want this show to be. And I don't want to just provide educational information or something that is enjoyable to hear. I hope those things apply. But there is also the desire to make things better, to take on tough issues, to make the people listening a little better, make you a little better, and the guests a little better, to make all of us a little better. That's the aim anyway. I don't know that we get there. A lot of times we don't. I know a lot of times in my own life, I'm not there. I'm not contributing in a way that's making things better. But I think there's something to be said about aiming for that. I would go so far as to propose that trying to make things better is intrinsic to being human. Let's think about it. We see someone drowning. What's the more human response? To walk by, take a photo? We hope that it's to actually get involved and try to help if possible. Doesn't always happen, but that's what we hope we would be like. At least I do. Like, I hope that I would have that state of mind, that inclination to help others and step in and try to improve things. Even with something like nature, right? We see these beautiful grasses of lawn, they're growing wild, right? Wild nature. And then we say, well, kind of need to trim it, take care of it. You don't want just unfettered growth. No, we need to improve on what's there, make it better. But I do believe that the Reno brothers are offering a valuable service to democracy by putting their lives at risk at times to show us the truth of what is happening, to explore a complicated issue in a personable way, in an empathic way. You heard Craig mention he was trying to tell the story of the Covenant House, and he gets beat up for his efforts. And yet he continues on with the story. That is admirable. That takes effort. It's difficult for me to do. When someone hurts me physically, but maybe more so emotionally, for me to say, okay, well, I'm not going to let that affect the way I treat that person. I'm going to still try to be a positive influence even to that person. It's tricky. I mean, not always something that I live up to. Sometimes I'll go out of my way to avoid that person. I try not to retaliate, but the temptation's there. On a bad day, it might happen, right? So it's no small thing to be able to take the punches, figurative or literal, that come when you're exploring these volatile issues. I mean, people are hurting. Sometimes there are issues that involve generations of pain, and you go and you step in, you try to add something, and the initial response might be negative. Someone's like, hey, what are you doing here? Are you just looking to get a story? Are you just trying to take advantage of this? Or do you actually care, right? Sometimes the people push back in a negative way to find out. And I guess I've even done that sometimes, just to feel what people are about. Are you just trying to do this thing because you want the industry connection, or what? Is there an actual connection here? I want to know. I also think that the really tough issues are not ones that we solve individually. We have people who can make progress on them, like, say, a Dr. Martin Luther King figure, big change came from his efforts. But to really address a problem, you have all the other people who support or add or have a different perspective to really make impact. And I would say we need the people on both sides of the spectrum politically. I think both sides have something valid to contribute if done in a civil way, not so much the kinds of conversations we've been having lately. It's almost like the candidates we got rose to the level of uncivility that we were having with ourselves, right? Those are the only candidates that could win in that kind of caustic environment, caustic conversations we have with ourselves. I think we can do better. I would say even beyond that, even beyond the big sociological issues, I mean, even personal issues, the things that we struggle with, we benefit from getting others on board. I mean, there are still challenges I face personally, or just trying to make things work in a creative industry. There are a number of challenges, a number of costs involved. A lot of people, most people don't make it work. And so we benefit, those who are trying to make this work long-term, benefit from different perspective. Oh, that's how you did things to make it work business-wise. Or, oh, that's an interesting creative approach to that technical challenge. And it's like the people who are really accomplished filmmakers or artists, they are the culmination of their own efforts, but also the insights they've gotten from others who have gone before, their friends, their partners, who accentuate the things that they don't do as well. It's a collaboration. All right. Well, I want to end my concluding thoughts here by touching a little bit more on Shelter. I really did enjoy Shelter quite a bit. One of the things the film does so well is it puts human faces to these homeless young people, people that we might normally dismiss. Oh, that's another homeless person. Well, we see people who are personable. I mean, you hear one of the gals singing a little off key, but in an endearing way. You get a sense that it's important to her and she's singing about love. Or you see another girl who is hurting when she comes to realize that she doesn't know some of the vocabulary that the recruiters might want her to know. She's got skills, but she just doesn't know some words, and that hurts. And you see that in her. Or you see someone who acknowledges the sense that he's never really been wanted, that he's been an annoyance to people. And that goes back to his family, his mom not really wanting him. And you see the hurt that resonates with him, but how he tries to cope and even find a sense of humor about it, right? So they show us the person behind the type. It's not just another homeless person. We talked about how they showed faith of the Covenant House. They didn't cut out that aspect. Some people might. They would say, well, we need to make this more mainstream, but it's at the heart of what they do. The organizer that we've mentioned in the past, he had a quote about St. Francis. He says, "We practice the Gospels all day long, and every once in a while, we have to use words." With that kind of generosity, that kind of helpfulness, you see the impact that it has. And this, more than the other films, you see the characters and you think, maybe there's a chance that things will get better for them. Not for sure. I mean, there's still going through issues. It's not a Pollyanna story where everything is resolved beautifully. They're still struggling, but you think, hey, maybe they might get better. Maybe there's a little bit of hope here. And in these difficult times, that is such a welcome thing to see. Sometimes these complicated issues, you see them, I see them, and I think, wow, what can be done here? Can we make any progress on this? Does it just get worse? And that's how it goes sometimes. We need to acknowledge the problems and say that there are not easy answers, but it was so encouraging to me to see that, yes, sometimes there can be hope that comes out of these situations. Part of that comes from just being able to care, right? Seeing people in need and saying, it might hurt a little bit, but I'm going to try to care as best I can. I'm going to try to open my heart and see what happens. And sometimes something hopeful emerges in those cases. All right. Well, that's our show. What are your thoughts? Are you working on any documentary projects? If so, would be interesting to hear about them. Leave a comment on the page or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. You can also see some of the work that the Renaud brothers have done on their site. As Craig mentioned, it's RenaudBrothers.com. They're also on Twitter. So if you connect to what they're doing, if you find this episode interesting, you can always send them a tweet on Twitter. I'm sure they'd appreciate that. They are at Renaud Brothers on Twitter. Again, look for the links on the show notes. Now, as some of you know, there's usually some kind of connection to the number 23 on some of the episodes, the ones that are on the 23rd, but I couldn't find one for the first time in a long time. Not the end of the world, obviously. It's just there have been so many of them. And so it was a little surprising this time when I couldn't find it. Maybe that thread has faded. It's run its course. All the possibilities that it presented of this long connection to the number, it's fading. Maybe it's gone. I don't know. Maybe that's for the best. It simplifies things. Does complicate things if it continues. And really, there's only one possible thing that could connect it at this point. That would be what happens with the Super Bowl this year. But I don't know. Maybe it's best to let that fade and move on to other things. All that to say, though, if you do happen to spot a connection to the number 23 with something in this episode, let me know, and I would be curious to see or hear about it. Because, you know, why not? One more thing to do during the day to stay out of trouble and so on. Email for that, once again, podcast@ncivitis.com. And remember, that's how you can message me about your favorite episode for a chance to get to say hello to our friendly, incredible, creative audience. So there's that. Music in this episode, beginning and the end, provided by Rob Koslow. It's the song True Gemini. If you like the show, if it provides value to you in some way, would you take a moment to share the episode or leave a nice comment on iTunes and hit that subscribe button so you can get all the episodes as soon as they come in? It's a small thing, but it would mean a lot to me. And it is a season of gratitude. So thank you for that. Thank you for your support, for keeping this show going. All right, until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.